We're going to talk this morning about Christian influence on American political thought. You may think there's not much of it left, but hopefully by the end... Yeah, we'll be done in a quarter till, no. Hopefully by the end of this you'll realize that it's still very significant. Mara?
I'll turn up a little bit, and then also speaking of the thing of increasing news, we have more food came in, so we didn't get refreshments. There's more there.
So the food makes it softer somehow.
Not really.
How's that? Okay. This has been like a pet topic of mine for a long time. You hear things, people say things like, "We want to completely, all religion should be removed from politics. There should be no Christianity left in our political system." I have a lot of quotes and Bible verses up here, but I found a really good one this morning that I want to read, and I didn't have time to get it into the PowerPoint. This is some quote by someone named Zoe Anadan. I don't know who he is, but it's on a website called religioustolerance.org. Listen carefully. I'm going to read it a couple of times, but listen carefully to what he says here. "You don't believe in separation of church and state? Question mark. Well, since you want your church to tell the government how to govern, does that mean the government can come into your church and tell you how to worship? Separation is for the protection of both." On the face of that, that sounds reasonable. There's a side to that that we all can agree with. But let me read one of the sentences again. "Since you want your church to tell the government how to govern..." Are we telling the government how to govern? Yes, and we always have. And there's a side to that which we should be really proud of. That's what I want to talk about this morning. I want to make the case that our political system is still based primarily on the Judeo-Christian values that we've talked about in... I've been talking for a lot of the time since I've been giving these talks. And not any others. To try to take those values away would change the system completely to the point where it would be unrecognizable. That's the case that I want to try to make this morning. Let's start with a little history. Has anybody heard the phrase the Great Awakening? Somebody tell me what the Great Awakening was.
Christian revival in North America.
Yeah, it was around 1740. So we're about 35 years before the American Revolution, before the Declaration of Independence. Okay, we had been British colonies for over 100 years at that point. What did church worship look like in 1730, 1740? Church, it was an Anglican church. It was very stoic. It was very unemotional. People got up there and read sermons. It was impersonal, and it was layered. There's a lot of hierarchy involved. Okay? There's a preacher comes along around 1739. His name is Jonathan Edwards. This guy was an amazing guy. This guy was, I hate this phrase, but it really sums it up. He was on fire for the Lord. He was very emotional, very excited about his faith. He started to preach about an immediate experience, an immediate relationship with the Lord. This started a true revival. I don't know if you guys have ever studied this or know much about it, but there are times in history, in different places in the world, where there have been true revivals, where the Spirit of God has worked in a people, and the people become, as a whole, not everyone of course, but they're much more aware of their religious faith, their faith is stronger. They're more excited about it. That's what happened in about 35 years before our revolution. Jonathan Edwards was joined by another preacher from England named George Whitefield. And George Whitefield came over here. Jonathan Edwards preached at his church. George Whitefield went all over the colonies. And he did what we would call like tent revivals now. He went from place to place to place and preached. He preached salvation. He preached that you can have a relationship with God, that this is a personal thing, much of the same stuff that we learn as evangelicals today. This was a big threat to the existing church. They didn't like this, because here's this guy coming into town, sets up a tent somewhere, preaches, and half the congregation goes and listens to him instead of coming to church. It was not a popular thing with the churches. But he attracted really large and emotional crowds all through all 13 colonies. He fostered, this movement fostered a lot of other itinerant preachers, preachers that moved from one place to another. This sort of breathed new life into the religious experience in America. All of this, this sort of fervor now for a relationship with God, this new language that's coming into the discourse as, you know, the next 30 years passed, ideas about individualism, ideas about liberty and equality, ideas about a relationship with God that's supposed to be exciting and fun and life-changing rather than stoic and impersonal. This is the milieu, this is the world that the founders grew up in. It played a key role, this revival played a key role in the foundation of our government. That's the Great Awakening. It put religion and its values on everyone's mind. George Whitefield has a quote about religious freedom. Quote, he's claiming liberty of conscience to be an inalienable right of every rational creature. Okay, we take that for granted now, but that wasn't that way then. That was a new idea. The church had a certain way of doing things, and you went to church and that's how you thought. The idea of the Enlightenment, we talk a lot about how many of our ideals as a country came from the Enlightenment. It's much less so than we realize. The Enlightenment ideal was that that society should be based on the idea of kings and aristocracy and the common man, that there was a hierarchy. The church was the same way. That's how they saw social stability. And along comes people like Whitefield and Jonathan Edwards, and it's different. People are thinking more in terms of equality, that God created everyone equal, and we all have a chance at this. Puritanism and the evangelism of the preachers of the Great Awakening challenged that. They were saying that the Bible taught that all men are equal and that the true value of a man lies in his moral behavior, not in his social class, which is where it was before. All of this set the stage for the coming revolution. So again, the founders were steeped in all of these new values and these new attitudes. There's an author named Donald Lutz, you can look him up on the internet, who studied 15,000 pamphlets, articles, and books of this time period. And the source that was cited the most in all of that literature was the Bible. And it was cited more than all the others combined, all the Enlightenment writers, all people like Franklin, all the people of the time. So the Bible was a huge influence. People were aware of the values. They weren't all Christians in the sense that we think of them, but they were steeped in those values. It wasn't the multicultural values that we have today. What I'm going to do is put up some quotes by many of our founders. These guys were presidents, these guys, people like Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, these are people who were foundational in the beginning of this country. And I think you'll be shocked at how religious what they have to say is. And I've got a lot. And I'm going to go through them, I'm going to read them, and if you have a question, fine, but let's go on. I want you to get a feel for how these people were thinking at the time around the American Revolution, okay? Benjamin Franklin, start with the oldest guy first. Now, Franklin did not believe that Jesus was God, but here's what he did believe. Here is my creed. I believe in one God, the creator of the universe, that he governs it by his providence, that he ought to be worshipped, that the most acceptable service we render to him is in doing good to his other children, that the soul of man is immortal and will be treated with justice in another life, respecting its conduct in this. These I take to be the fundamental points in all sound religion, and I regard them as you do in whatever sect I meet with them. As to Jesus of Nazareth, my opinion of whom you particularly desire, I think the system of morals and his religion as he left them to us is the best the world ever saw or is likely to see. Keep in mind that the word religion, when you hear it in these quotes, it doesn't mean what it means now. It didn't mean Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam. It meant Christianity, and it meant specifically Protestant Christianity. So when they talk about different sects, they're talking about different, Puritanism or Methodism or Baptism, Presbyterian. Right. Okay.
No Judaism?
Judaism's there. We're getting there. We're getting there. George Washington. We all know who he is. While we are zealously performing the duties of good citizens and soldiers, we certainly ought not to be inattentive to the higher duties of religion. To the distinguished character of patriot, it should be our highest glory to add the more distinguished character of Christian. Imagine the president saying that now. Okay, that was first president. Second president, John Adams. Suppose a nation in some distant region should take the Bible for their only law book, and every member should regulate his conduct by the precepts there exhibited. Every member would be obliged in conscience to temperance, frugality, and industry, to justice, kindness, and charity towards his fellow man, and to piety, love, and reverence toward Almighty God. What a utopia, what a paradise would this region be. Third president, Thomas Jefferson. I am a real Christian, that is to say, a disciple of the doctrines of Jesus Christ. Again, he did not believe in the deity of Jesus, but he believed in his moral principles. Fourth president, James Madison. Cursed be all that learning that is contrary to the cross of Christ. Wow, that sums it up. Monroe, fifth president. When we view the blessings with which our country has been favored, those which we now enjoy, and the means which we possess of handing them down unimpaired to our latest posterity, our attention is irresistibly drawn to the source from whence they flow. Let us then unite in offering our most grateful acknowledgments for those blessings to the divine author of all good. Sixth president, John Quincy Adams, son of John Adams. The hope of a Christian is inseparable from his faith. Whoever believes in the divine inspiration of the Holy Scriptures must hope that the religion of Jesus shall prevail throughout the earth. Never since the foundation of the world have the prospects of mankind been more encouraging to that hope than they appear to be at the present time. And may the associated distribution of the Bible proceed and prosper till the Lord shall have made bare his holy arm in the eyes of all the nations, and all the ends of the earth shall see the salvation of our God. Pretty remarkable. Okay, let's go back a little. Sam Adams, cousin to John Adams, second president. And as it is our duty to extend... Oh, he was also... He made good beer, too. And as it is our duty to extend our wishes to the happiness of the great family of man, I conceive that we cannot better express ourselves than by humbly supplicating the supreme ruler of the world, then the rod of tyrants may be broken to pieces and the oppressed made free again, that wars may cease in all the earth, and that the confusions that are and have been among nations may be overruled by promoting and speedily bringing on that holy and happy period when the kingdom of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ may be everywhere established, and all people everywhere willingly bow to the scepter of him who is Prince of Peace. William Penn, founder of Pennsylvania. I do declare to the whole world that we believe the Scriptures to contain a declaration of the mind and will of God in and to those ages in which they were written, being given forth by the Holy Ghost moving in the hearts of holy men of God, that they ought also to be read, believed, and fulfilled in our day, being used for reproof and instruction that the man of God may be perfect. They are a declaration and a testimony of heavenly things themselves, and as such, we carry a high respect for them. We accept them as the words of God Himself. John Adams again. The second day of July 1776, and I think what was happening here, I think the Declaration of Independence was ratified on the 2nd of July and then signed on the 4th. Everybody at the time expected the 2nd of July to be the holiday. The second day of July, 1776, will be the most memorable epoch in the history of America. I am apt to believe that it will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival. It ought to be commemorated as the day of deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty. It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, illuminations, and NFL games. From one end of this continent to the other, from this time forward forever. Boy, he got the last half of that right, didn't he? Benjamin Rush. This guy's a really interesting character. This guy was a physician, good friend of John Adams. One of my favorite books that I've read in the last few years was David McCullough's John Adams biography, and he talks a lot about Benjamin Rush. He's a very interesting character. The Gospel of Jesus Christ prescribes the wisest rules for just conduct in every situation of life. Happy they are who are enabled to obey them in all situations. Benjamin Rush again. If moral precepts alone could have reformed mankind, the mission of the Son of God into all the world would have been unnecessary. The perfect morality of the gospel rests upon the doctrine which, though often controverted, has never been refuted. I mean the vicarious life and death of the Son of God. Boy, this is meaty stuff, isn't it? Another Benjamin Rush. Christianity is the only true and perfect religion, and that in proportion as mankind adopts its principles and obeys its precepts, they will be wise and happy. Alexander Hamilton on the $10 bill. I have carefully examined the evidences of the Christian religion, and if I was sitting as a juror upon its authenticity, I would unhesitatingly give my verdict in its favor. I can prove its truth as clearly as any proposition ever submitted to the mind of men. You don't hear this version in school, do you? Patrick Henry, the Bible is a book worth more than all the other books that were ever printed. John Jay, the Bible will also inform them that our gracious Creator has provided for us a Redeemer, in whom all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, that this Redeemer has made atonement for the sins of the whole world, and thereby reconciling the divine justice with the divine mercy has opened a way for our redemption and salvation, and that these inestimable benefits are of the free gift and grace of God, not of our deserving, nor in our power to deserve. Okay. This, you can see where the culture was at, how people were thinking at the time of the revolution. Now, how much of this attitude seeped into our founding documents? What was their intent? What did they want to do with this new nation that they were creating, that they realized was one of the most amazing opportunities in the history of Earth to come up with a whole new form of government? What did they want it to look like? What were they basing it on? Let's take their words. John Adams. The general principles on which the fathers achieved independence were the general principles of Christianity. Can it be any clearer? I will avow that I then believed and now believe that those general principles of Christianity are as eternal and immutable as the existence and attributes of God. George Washington's farewell address. Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. John Adams. This quote and the next quote are probably my favorite too. Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Patrick Henry. It cannot be emphasized too strongly or too often that this great nation was founded not by religionists, but by Christians. Not on religions, but on the gospel of Jesus Christ. For this very reason, peoples of other faiths have been afforded asylum, prosperity, and freedom of worship here. The Puritans believed, the founders believed, that our Christian values absolutely should infuse the way we did government and the way we related to each other through our government. Let's start talking about Christian principles that are still in our political system. And I hope you're shocked. I hope you find that there's still an amazing amount of them. The very first one that I want to talk about is, most people would not think of it as a biblical idea, but that's the basic idea that is so formative in what we believe, the basic idea of the separation of church and state. There is a couple of biblical precedents for the idea of separation of church and state. In Israel, the 12 tribes, the tribe of Judah appointed the kings, the tribe of Levi were the priests and the keeper of the law. God knew that that was important to keep those two functions separate. What did Jesus say? Jesus said, "Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, unto God what is God's." I don't believe that. I think given human nature, which the founders really understood pretty well, you can't have a theocracy. You cannot have the people who run the church run the government. It's too much power in the hands of one set of people, and it will not work. And it took Christians, you know, about 1,700 years to figure this out. But it's that idea is based on the biblical idea that we are corrupt, that human beings, given enough power, every one of us will become corrupt. Okay? Now, I want to talk about what the founding fathers meant by separation of church and state. Let's look first at what does the Constitution actually say? And this is all it says about religion. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Supreme Court sort of forgotten about the last half of that. They've got the no law respecting an establishment of religion part worked out. Okay. Now, how many of you are aware that the phrase separation of church and state, does anybody know where that came from? It's not in any of our founding documents. Thomas Jefferson wrote it in a letter in 1802, which is 26 years after our founding. He only used the phrase once. This is the letter. He wrote it to Danbury Baptist Association, who was worried that the federal government was going to authorize a official church. And this is his reaction to that. And this is while he was president. "Believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legislative powers of government reach actions only and not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of a religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state." Now, we all agree with this to some extent. There are ways in which religion should be separate from the church. But it looks to me, in reading this, that what Jefferson was saying was, he's not trying to keep, they were trying to keep government out of the church, not church out of the government. The founders were very worried about that. Okay? So, the founders, the people who set this up, would look at where we've gone with the idea of separation of church and state, and they would say, "You guys are crazy, you've gone way too far with it. We never intended that." They found it perfectly fine to make arguments based on religious ideas, as you can see. Yes.
Are you taking...
Sure, why not?
I think I've seen this quote before. It's the first time I've noticed right in the middle of it, it says the legislative powers of government reach actions only and not opinions.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
It is. So, yeah. Sounds like he's talking about what beliefs you hold, that the government has no business meddling with your personal beliefs, thought police kind of thing.
That's right.
But they do have a business with our actions.
That's correct. Yeah, that's how I take it. John?
The phrase establishment of a religion in this context, am I not correct that they had in mind it shall not respect the establishment of any Christian denomination over another?
Yes, remember your history. In Europe, these guys were all Europeans. in England. Whoever was the monarch, if they were a Protestant, they were subjugating the Catholics. If they were Catholics, they oppressed the Protestants. In Puritan, in the colonies before this, there were, each state had a sect of Protestantism that they supported. The ministers were actually paid by the state. They were employees of the state. And what they were trying to do was get away from that system. So when they said make no law respecting an establishment of religion, what it means is the federal government cannot condone, support, pay for, in any way promote one group of Protestant, you know, Baptists or whatever, over another. That's what that meant. Okay? Now, in our pluralistic society, it has to mean more than that. But understand that that's what was intended. The federal government will not promote one group over another. People are free to worship, make their own decisions about things. Now, it's very interesting that this is only the federal government. I don't have it in here, but even Thomas Jefferson, who was one of the most, you know, the less Christian that, in the sense that, that we think of it, he was most adamant about separation of church and state. Even he thought it was fine for this individual state to have a church that they supported. That didn't go away until, I think, the last one was like 1830 or 1840. Ted?
Ross, you've done a marvelous job of compiling this information. Can you make your PowerPoint available and give that to Brother Dean here?
Sure.
This
yeah.
is important stuff. It should not die in this classroom.
Well, thank you.
Go on the net to our friends.
Yeah, I will give it to him.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay. Let's. What are there any references to religion in our founding documents? There's almost none in the Constitution, but in the Declaration of Independence there are. Let's look at those. Religious statements in the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence proclaims, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." Why was it self-evident? Because virtually everybody at the time believed it. No one, there was no dissenting opinions about that. We, yeah.
But didn't they still have slaves?
Yep, they sure did.
So they're contradicting themselves.
It took us as a society 150 years to catch up with these wonderful words. They believed it as far as they could take it. But they couldn't take it the whole way. Remember, this is founding documents. It's not the Bible. I believe they were inspired by God, but they didn't get it completely right. Scott?
Last night I was watching 10 Things That You Don't Know, and they did Benjamin Franklin. He owned slaves, but he was the first abolitionist, the only founding father that was an abolitionist, and he was the president of the American Abolitionist.
I didn't know that. Wow. John?
I know that slavery was a major topic of controversy in the communist economies. And they finally decided to tolerate it so that they could at least get a union.
Yes.
It was by a very great reluctance that they didn't make any specific prohibitions, and of course it finally was settled.
If we had dealt with this issue at the time, we would be two countries now. And there were a lot of founders who knew, they saw it coming. They said, sooner or later, we're going to fight over this. And they were right. But that was the best they could do at the time. As well, this text references the laws of nature and of nature's God, and closes by appealing to the supreme judge of the world and noting the signer's reliance on the protection of divine providence. So they were very clear. It was very clear in their mind where these ideas were coming from and why they were doing what they were doing. Okay, let's talk about another biblical idea that's built into our system. It's called the separation of powers. What does the Bible say about human nature? Somebody tell me.
We're fallen.
We're fallen. What does that mean to be fallen? We're sinners. What does it mean to be a sinner?
Evil.
Well, no. Self-serving. Selfish.
Corrupt.
Corrupt. What is it? But what does it say about the other side of us?
Imago Dei.
Imago Dei. We're made in God's image. We have the ability to reason. We have the ability to turn to God. We have the ability to think. We have the ability to improve ourselves as time goes on. So both of those things are true. We can be fabulous and wonderful, and in the next breath we can be hating and killing. That's human nature. That's never going to change. So one of the things they were up against is, how do we keep whoever's in charge from becoming so corrupt that they destroy everything that we're doing? Well, they came up with this idea of the separation of powers. Now, I don't want you to be able to follow this as much as just look and see how complicated it is. Okay, this is how legislation is enacted in our country. Somebody comes up with the idea, the law is proposed, it's drafted by the House, the Senate writes their version, House and Senate leaders meet to work out the differences, they submit it to the President. The President can do three things. He can veto it, approve it, or veto or approve it, two things. If he approves it, the bill becomes law. If he vetoes it, if he says it's a bad idea, then it can go back to Congress and they can override it with a two-thirds vote. Or they can modify it, or they can do nothing. And even after the bill becomes law, the Supreme Court, which is another entity, can come in and say it's unconstitutional. Now, why did they make it that complicated?
Checks and balances.
Checks and balances. They wanted a lot of people with different interests from different places to decide on whether these things were a good idea. They made the process cumbersome on purpose. They didn't want things being able to be changed easily. That's right. Okay. These bodies, the Congress, the House, Senate, President, Supreme Court, how are they chosen? President is chosen by the Electoral College, which a lot of us don't understand what that's for, but it's basically a popular vote. House of Representatives, every 2 years, by popular vote. The Senate, I bet you didn't know this. Originally, the senators were chosen by the state legislatures, not by direct vote. It was 1912 when that was changed. I think we should go back to the way it was, because here's what it does. It puts representatives of the states and the states' rights in Washington. Right now, the way it is now, nobody represents the states. I would rather have two senators who I disagree with politically who come from the state legislature of California and therefore make decisions based on states' interests than on two senators I disagree with politically who make decisions that they think are good for the whole country. Who's representing the state? But again, that was changed, but the way it was originally done, you see what's here, the people are represented and the states are represented. Supreme Court, you know, is those people are nominated for lifetime terms by the President, but with the consent of Congress. As we all know, sometimes the President nominates somebody and Congress says no. So there's all these checks and balances, all these different interests, all these different groups, people that are interested in states, people that are interested in federal government. Everybody's got a hand in this and gets to say, indirectly, but they get to say what's going on. Then there's, again, states' rights versus the federal government. In colonial America, the best way to think about it was we were 13 different countries. All the colonies had their own money, they had their own laws, they traded with each other, but they weren't thinking in terms of the United States of America. When the first national constitution was so, it wasn't the one we have now. It was so loose that it didn't work, and they trashed it, and they came up with the one that we have now. But it was very important to the founders that the rights of the states remained in our political system. They did not want to give all their power away to the federal government. The federal government had certain particular things that they were going to be able to do. But everything else was supposed to be left to the states. Now, as we've gone along through almost 250 years, the federal government has gotten more and more powerful, and states' rights have gotten smaller and smaller. I think we should get back to more things being decided by the states.
In the Constitution, or where is that written out for us, states' rights?
I'm telling you what they were thinking.
Oh, they were just thinking.
But if you read the Constitution, there are a lot of people who say that what the Constitution was originally intended for the federal government to do is very limited. Mm-hmm. Was never intended to be this big and this overreaching. Right. But my point here is that they had this tension in their minds. They wanted some things to be decided by individual states. They wanted some things to be decided by the federal government. Because then they were in competition for each other. And again, nobody had too much power. John?
Well, I was just going to mention that they were very concerned by a powerful federal government. I mentioned that very limited functions the government, well, the federal government is supposed to have to expand and some other things, and that the Tenth Amendment does indicate that anything not explicitly granted by the Constitution remains the province of the state alone. And today we have the vast majority of federal expenditures in violation of that provision.
Mm-hmm.
To answer your question, Google enumeration of power.
Yeah. Then the last check that the founders intended was the press. They wanted, you may not know this, but they wanted a free, unfettered press because they knew that they would go and check up on all these guys, and it was in their interest to find some scandalous, horrible story and make everybody aware of it. They saw that. They saw the press as indispensable to making this work and to keep everybody honest. Okay, so when we complain about the press overreaching, they do, but they're also there for a very good reason.
Well, it's interesting because with John Kennedy and his womanizing, the press never mentioned that whatsoever. I think wasn't there sort of a code that you just crossed
sometimes,
or at least at that time?
Franklin Roosevelt was in a wheelchair for almost his entire administration.
Was that for the security of the country that they didn't want?
I don't think so, but he was always shown seated, and a lot of the country didn't even know that he was in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
So all of this is based on a biblical view of human nature. My way of saying it is, one of the reasons this country has been great and has continued the tradition that the founders intended was that no one person can get powerful enough to mess it up. There's so many other people checking all the time on what he's doing, and this is very much based on biblical idea of human nature. Jim?
Back in the separation of powers, you should note that the Congress, if you look at the legislature, it's the most powerful of the entire branch of all the three branches. And so they divided it up into two different houses and amongst so many people.
That's a good point. You're right.
If you, read the Constitution, you look at all the powers granted to them, and you put that in one power and one person, like in the presidency, that's what you call a dictator.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, we have two legislative bodies, Senate and the House, not just one, for the same reason, so they can balance and check each other. James Madison, in Federalist Paper number 51, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal or internal controls on government would be necessary. See, they had a very clear view of human nature. Okay, here's some more very religious Christian ideas that are in our founding documents.
Separation of church and state. I forget which Congress it was, but they commissioned and paid for Bibles to be printed and distributed all over the country.
Sure.
So that every town got a Bible.
Because it was very clear in their minds where these ideas came from that this country was founded on. Okay, here's these. John,
I'll just follow quickly. I know that in the early days of the country, that there were regular 3-hour Sunday services in the House of Representatives that almost everyone attended. They were very diligent in having, and it was a governmental sponsored function.
People's attention span was a lot longer in the late 1850s when Lincoln and Douglas were carrying on their debates. They barnstormed together and they would go town to town. This was the only chance a lot of people ever had to see or hear the candidates. They would go into town and they would talk for 7 hours. They would debate for all day, and nobody thought anything of it. They wanted the kit. They wanted everything covered. So yeah.
Oh,
okay. Here's these radical Christian ideas that are also in the founding documents: liberty, freedom, and individualism. The founders saw liberty as the freedom to do what is morally correct. Okay? Let's look at some quotes on liberty, freedom, and individualism. James Wilson, this guy was a Supreme Court justice. Without liberty, law loses its nature and its name and becomes oppression. Without law, liberty also loses its nature and its name and becomes licentiousness.
What does Latin mean, licentiousness?
Doing whatever you want, evil looseness, yeah. Thomas Jefferson letter to the Baptist Association again. This is only part of it. Believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship. These were radical ideas at the time, or 30 years before in the Great Enlightenment. George Mason, draft of Virginia Declaration of Rights. This was in 1776. That as religion, or the duty which we owe to our divine and omnipotent Creator, and the manner of discharging it, can be governed only by reason and conviction, not by force or violence, and therefore that all men should enjoy the fullest toleration in the exercise of religion, according to the dictates of conscience, unpunished and unrestrained by the magistrate. Thomas Jefferson, again. This is awesome. Listen to this. God, who gave us life, gave us liberty. And can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we have removed their only firm basis, the conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are the gift of God, that they are not to be violated but with his wrath? Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever, that a revolution of the wheel of fortune, a change of situation, is among possible events, that it may become probable by supernatural influence. The Almighty has no attribute which can take side with us in that event. Mara?
Now, I understand that they all were thinking Christian. How do we deal with this today, with Islam? I mean, if you want to apply this to this, how do we deal with
it? I'm going to get to that at the end, and I'm going to try to make it to the end here. So, John Hancock. Resistance to tyranny becomes the Christian and social duty of each individual. In other words, we're not supposed to be passive. We're supposed to do something about tyranny. Continue steadfast and with a proper sense of your dependence on God. Nobly defend those rights which heaven gave, and no man ought to take from us. They were very clear on where these rights were coming from. If those rights came from government, government can take them away. If those rights come from God, nobody can take them away. And they were putting themselves as a government. They were admitting. I mean, who in government would say that? Who in government would admit, we're not giving you these rights. God is giving you these rights. We can't take them away. That's just taking power away from themselves. But that's what they said. John Witherspoon, signer of the Declaration of Independence. What follows from this, that he is the best friend to American liberty, who is most sincere and active in promoting true and undefiled religion, and who sets himself with the greatest firmness to bear down profanity and immorality of every kind. Benjamin Rush again. The only foundation for a useful education in a republic is to be laid in religion. Without this, there can be no virtue, and without virtue, there can be no liberty. Okay, what does the Bible say about the idea of liberty, freedom? Galatians. Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty by which Christ has made us free, and do not be entangled again with a yoke of bondage. Philippians 2:12. Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. It's up to each one of us. Not that we can't do it without help, or that the church isn't there. We're not supposed to do it completely independently, but it's our own individual responsibility to work out this stuff. And the founders were very clear on that. Our system gives everyone the right to vote and get involved in the political system. doesn't matter whether you're educated, uneducated, intelligent, what your religious views are, age, sex, gender, with the idea that collectively we will make the right decision. That's what they were counting on. No one has more of a right to do that than another, although it's like the slavery issue, because when this was all done, only male landowners could vote. Now, as we've become more mature as a country, we've taken these words seriously and imposed them on ourselves and gotten rid of slavery and given women the right to vote, and everybody gets to vote, not just landowners, and there's been a lot of progress in the basic direction of these ideas. But these ideas got us started. Ezekiel 18, 19, and 20. I just came across these verses a few weeks ago. I wasn't aware of them. But this sets the stage for individual thought rather than collective thought. Remember, we've talked in the past about how the culture, the biblical cultures, were very collective. But here, way back in Ezekiel, yet you say, why should the son not bear the guilt of the father? Well, we think that's a stupid question. Why should he? But in that time, that was the norm. Because the son has done what is lawful and right and has kept all my statutes and observed them, he shall surely live. The soul who sins shall die. The son shall not bear the guilt of the father, nor the father bear the guilt of the son. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked shall be upon himself.
Isn't that a radical concept?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, it is. It was. Here's an interesting one. Public service. Think about what that word means. Service. Okay? This is based on the idea, in the verse in the Bible, there's many of them, where Jesus says, the first shall be last, and the last shall be first. The entire basis of government in the founder's eyes was modeled on God's covenant with Abraham. The idea was that men of learning, men who were educated, men who had the mind and the desire to serve in government, would stop what they were doing for a year or two or six in the case of the Senate and go and do public service. The word service, listen to that word, it meant to be a sacrifice. They would humble themselves, they would go work in government, they would do the right thing for the people. But the whole basis of the idea, the word public service, public servant, was based on God's covenant with Abraham. That it was not forced, it was voluntary, and that both parties have gained advantages. Very interesting. You don't learn that in school. Public service, that's what it originally meant. Okay, here's another radical idea from the Bible. Equality. Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. What they meant was, we're equal in God's eyes. It doesn't mean we all have the same intelligence, lifespan, health, happiness, outlook. But we are equal in the ways that matter. And what are the ways that matter? God loves us. His offer of salvation is to every one of us. We're all fallen, selfish, and self-destructive, but we're made in His image. We're all going to die. In those ways, we're equal. And that's what the founders were acknowledging when they said that.
It's interesting that they said that all men and not women. They didn't say women.
Well, I think generically it meant
generic.
Women. Yeah.
Generic?
Oh.
Looking for a loophole. Ah, yeah.
The basis for our modern idea of equality is the Bible. Man did not dream this idea up. It's another radical Christian idea that's in our system is human rights and dignity. The idea of equality that we just talked about then gives us the idea of human rights and human dignity. It flows from it naturally. We don't have a direct democracy. We don't vote for things directly because the founders knew that that would lead to mob rule. We have a representational form of government. People make decisions for us, so things can't happen too quick. They did not want a direct democracy because they knew that minorities would be oppressed. Because the majority would simply say, whatever the horrible thing they wanted to have happen. They did not want that to happen. You've been had your hand up for a while.
Yes, sir. I'm just planning to say that one, as a pastor, 1.5 years ago, I came to America, and I think I discovered that Christianity has become an endangered species. That's my way of thinking. So it's amazing to see all of these things, this thing. And I'm wondering that where is the what is happening? I say this with a big burden because a pastor came from Africa to one of the seminaries in California and became a Muslim. You know, became an Islamic preacher.
Yes.
You see. But even from ICS, where I come from, which is an international seminary, I'm told to be careful about, you know, my emotions about Christianity or about my West. So I'm trying to ask that, where is it that America doesn't have people who can have their Christians who are willing to make their convictions about this Christianity known, or what is the problem?
Well, thank you. And that's one of the things I'm going to say at the end, is that we need to be much more bold in talking about where these values came from. We all agree with these values, whether you're a believer or not. These are all things that we hold dear. But we need to be able to say boldly where these ideas came from. Okay, what does the Bible say about human rights and dignity? James 1:27. Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their trouble. You know, the Bible in many ways, I never thought about it this way, but the Bible really talks a lot about the underdog. It talks about people who are oppressed, who are forgotten, who just don't have any opportunities in life. Those were the people that Jesus especially was interested in. Blessed is he who considers the poor. The Lord will deliver him in time of trouble. The Lord will preserve him and keep him alive, and he will be blessed on the earth. You will not deliver him to the will of his enemies. The Lord will strengthen him on his bed of illness. You will sustain him on his sick bed. Then he will also say to those on the left hand, depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not take me in. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison, and you did not visit me. This is very important to the Lord, that the people that are the lowest, the smallest in the culture, that we take care of them. Psalm 146. Happy is he who has the God of Jacob for his help, whose hope is in the Lord his God, who executes justice for the oppressed, who gives food to the hungry. The Lord gives freedom to the prisoners. The Lord opens the eyes of the blind. The Lord raises those who are bowed down. The Lord loves the righteous. The Lord watches over the strangers. He relieves the fatherless and widow. But the way of the wicked he turns upside down. Okay. It was not Hinduism, Buddhism, atheism, materialism, Islam, secularism, or the Enlightenment that gave us freedom, liberty, equality, human rights, separation of church and state, individualism, or the concept of public service. It was Christianity. Listen, here's a quote from Calvin Coolidge, President number 30. Our government rests upon religion. It is from that source that we derive our reverence for truth and justice, for equality and liberality, and for the rights of mankind. Unless the people believe in these principles, they cannot believe in our government. There are only two main theories of government in the world. One rests on righteousness, the other on force. One appeals to reason, the other appeals to the sword. One is exemplified in a republic, the other is represented by despotism. The government of a country never gets ahead of the religion of a country. There is no way by which we can substitute the authority of the law for the virtue of men. Of course, we can help to restrain the vicious and furnish a fair degree of security and protection by legislation and police control, but the real reform which society in these days is seeking will come as a result of religious conviction, or they will not come at all. Peace, justice, charity. These cannot be legislated into being. They are the result of divine grace.
Wow.
That's the President of the United States about 100 years ago. If we are to maintain these values that are in our political system, that we all value, Christian or non-Christian, whatever your belief system is, I don't think I've said anything in here that we don't all agree with. But if we're to maintain them, we have to realize that they did not come from the mind of man, which can change easily, but from the mind of God. These values are eternal, and in my opinion, they produce the highest level of affluence and peace and happiness. If you don't believe, well, I'll get there. When we teach our history, it's essential to teach where these values come from. And in my opinion, that's teaching history, not teaching religion. Okay? Now, let's go back to what people are saying about how we should remove Christianity from the political system. I hope you can see now how impossible that would be. Christianity and its values are so woven into our system that to remove them would make the system unrecognizable. It would be like taking trees out of the forest and still calling it a forest. What would it be like? Let's take these one at a time real quickly. And I've got like 5 minutes and I can finish, even though it's time to go, if you guys will grant me those 5 minutes. What would our system look like without the basic freedoms that we have? Could we still call ourselves America? What would it look like without the idea of equality? We'd go back to ancient Rome or the days of slavery. What would it look like without human rights? Well, look around the world and look at some of the other regimes that don't honor human rights. Is that where we would want to go? Do we want to take that Christian value out of our system? Really? Separation of church and state. Look in the Muslim world. They don't believe in that. They think that's a ridiculous concept. They believe in a theocracy. Whoever runs the church should run the country. Look how where they're at. Separation of powers. Where would we be? We'd be back to a king. Just one guy. If you happen to get a good one, you're set. If you happen to get a bad one, it's not so great. Where would we be without individual rights and responsibilities? We just have somebody telling us what to do all the time. Where would we be without the idea of public service, which we sort of are, because not too many of them get it. But all right, I want to finish now with, here's what I'm taking away from this, and I hope I want to share this. These are the ideas that I think that we can, as we see this differently now, we can go away with. I think we should be very bold in showing how our Judeo-Christian values help shape our political thought and how these ideas are supported by virtually everyone in our culture, believer or non-believer. We should realize that when we do this, we're teaching history, we're not evangelizing. We're just saying, this idea, this is where it came from. We can't let go of where it came from. Explain that these ideas are so powerful, they're so transformative if we adopt them, I don't think they could have come from the mind of man. This is actually a witnessing tool. We don't have a perfect society, but to the extent that we adopt these biblical principles, we have the best society that can be had this side of heaven. That even though all other religious traditions are a part of our pluralistic culture, and should be, there should be a deference to and a respect for Christianity, because it is only in Christianity that there is a mandate and a tradition of tolerance and respect for all other belief systems. Ironically, if we don't keep Christianity in the forefront, we will lose the ability to be tolerant and understanding and loving of the other systems. We need to continue to remind ourselves and others, whether we like it or not, these are religious ideas. These are Christian ideas. They did not come from anywhere else. Now, here's one that I'm going to say that's a little more controversial. We need to explain to others that when we express our views on controversial subjects like abortion, like gay marriage, we are simply continuing this tradition of using biblical principles in our system. And the Bible has worked so well to this point. Why would we abandon it now? All of this should be done, and this is the main point where Christians mess it up the most. All of this should be done with humility and patience and love, because everybody was created equal in God's eyes. We have no right, none at all, to look down on anyone else. There is no inferior people in this world. Only by the grace of God, I would not be a radical Muslim or some other person that I don't want to be. It's only because I was born here and God chose me, and I had no control over that. Okay? So don't get on a high horse about these ideas. Okay? Let me close with this one quote. George Washington, this was his Thanksgiving Day proclamation the first year he was president. Whereas it is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey His will, to be grateful for His benefits, and humbly to implore His protection and favor, I do recommend the people of these states to the service of that great and glorious being, who is the beneficent author of all the good that was, that is, or that will be, and also that we may then unite in most humbly offering our prayers and supplication to the great Lord and ruler of nations, and beseech Him to pardon our national and other transgressions, to enable us all, whether in public or private stations, to perform our several and relative duties properly and punctually, to render our national government a blessing to all the people. Thank you very much. I'll answer questions if anybody wants to stay, or you can all go and eat. John?
The idea that the church is the concept.